Hello and welcome to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with filmmaker Rick Ray about his documentary about the Dalai Lama entitled 10 Questions for the Dalai Lama. We'll also include a commentary from Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report about the presidential campaign of Senator Barack Obama. And we'll feature some announcements of events of interest to Chicagoans. But now, a selection of news about media and democracy entitled Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The 30-nation chartered Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development's latest statistics on broadband infrastructure ranks the United States 15th in the world with regard to the deployment of broadband technology. That has Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii worried about the country's future in terms of our information economy.
Well, some will debate what in fact these rankings measure. One thing that cannot be debated is the fact we continue to fall further down the list.
The United States ranked 12th in the world with regard to broadband infrastructure just a year ago, and when it comes to growth in broadband penetration alone, the U.S. ranks 20th out of 30. Speaking in front of the Senate Commerce Committee on the subject April 24th, Free Press Policy Director Ben Scott told lawmakers that a lack of competition between the dominant phone and cable companies, coupled with abysmal regulatory research on the broadband marketplace, means we'll continue to fall behind unless a national broadband development policy is implemented. The first step, says Scott, is for the Federal Communications Commission to stop cooking its numbers to paint a rosy picture of broadband in America. A recent report from the FCC touts significant growth in wireless broadband as a sign that things are improving, but Scott says that's not an honest reading of reality.
Broadband-capable cell phones, like BlackBerries and Trios, much as I love mine, are expensive, they are slow, and they're seldom used as substitutes for a wireline connection at home. We would be wise to shelve the hype on this point about wireless broadband and face the reality that it's not yet a substitutable competitor.
Although the majority of Americans now have access to some sort of broadband service, whether it be DSL, cable modem, satellite, or wireless, nearly half the population still doesn't subscribe to any of them. Scott believes that's in part due to incumbent providers trying to squeeze the most profit out of the system possible.
American consumers routinely pay between $7 and $10 a megabit. Compare that to the less than $1 that the top nations in the world pay. In short, American consumers are paying less for more than our global counterparts. We're still about 60% of Americans are not yet broadband subscribers, either because it isn't available, it isn't affordable, or it simply isn't attractive enough for them to buy.
Senator Inouye says Congress will work to correct this problem with two specific pieces of legislation.
First is the Broadband Data Development Act to improve broadband data collection at both the federal and state levels. Second, the Advanced Information and Communications Technology Research Act, which will promote innovation here in the United States.
It's a far cry from a national push to make broadband as ubiquitous as electricity, but you have to start somewhere. Other initiatives that could seriously improve access to broadband in America include utilizing old analog TV spectrum for new wireless broadband services, protecting the rights of local and state governments to establish publicly funded broadband networks to compete with private providers, and reforming the FCC's Universal Service Fund, which was originally set up to bring telephone service to every corner of the country, to now cover the development of broadband networks in unserved areas.
The FCC's recently released new rules on radio payola sure leave a lot to be desired. CBS Radio, Entercom, Clear Channel, and Citadel Broadcasting have agreed to collectively pay $12.5 million to settle an investigation into whether they took cash and gifts from record companies funneled through music promoters in order to favor the airplay of certain artists. The settlement did not require the companies to admit guilt and still leaves them open to receiving lots of swag from the music business. For example, broadcasters may still take up to 20 concert tickets at a time, quote, to be used by company employees to familiarize them with the performing artists. They can still be wined and dined up to $150 per sitting by label representatives and can still receive travel and lodging stipends from labels to industry events. Broadcasters can also still solicit large ticket gifts from the music industry to give away for station contests and other business, provided they disclose the value of these gifts on air and clearly identify the benefactor. The only tracking mechanisms put in place by the FCC's decree involve the four broadcasters hiring a compliance officer to oversee legal payola, and they all must assemble a database cataloging everything they receive from record labels. What's more, the terms of the payola settlement only run for 3 years, meaning the commitments the four broadcast companies have made to play independent artists will expire after that time.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
On Friday, March 2nd, the government announced its decision on the royalty rates internet radio webcasters must pay the music industry to license the music we play. The problem is the new rates amount to well over 100% of even the most successful webcasters' online radio revenues. This means unless the rates are changed, most or all of your favorite internet radio stations will be bankrupt and the industry will go silent. Let your representatives in Congress know you want them to step in and do something to save internet radio. Visit SaveTheStreams.org today to sign our online petition and learn how to contact your representatives in Congress. Get the facts at SaveTheStreams.org. Thanks.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepanchik. We now feature an interview with filmmaker Rick Ray about his documentary about the Dalai Lama entitled 10 Questions for the Dalai Lama. The following interview was recorded on Saturday, April 28, 2007. We are joined on the phone with Rick Ray. Rick Ray is a filmmaker who is also the director, cinematographer, writer, and producer of the film 10 Questions for the Dalai Lama, a documentary about the leading figure in the Buddhist faith. And Rick Ray is joining us from Santa Barbara, California. Rick, are you there?
I'm right here.
Rick, thank you very much for joining us and welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. My pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about a general sense about the film. What is the film about? Tell us a little bit about what it's about, and why did you make the film?
Well, this is essentially a documentary that happened almost by accident. I was in India shooting a different film for another company, and that company got me to make the film for almost nothing because they had promised me an interview with the Dalai Lama. So I was over in India shooting, and when I got there, I realized that the company and everybody involved had not made any plan whatsoever to meet His Holiness or to arrange an interview. So while I was there, I became determined to visit Dharamsala, India, where the Dalai Lama lives in exile today from Tibet, and try to get a little bit of his time to create a film. What happened was that, I didn't have Richard Gere's phone number. And I didn't have any contacts at all to try to meet His Holiness. But oddly enough, I was assigned on this other film production to an 80-year-old driver who had taken guests everywhere over the last 40 years around India. And his name was Gita Ram. And he came up to me on day one and handed me a little business card that said, "In charge." And Gita Ram, my driver, was in charge of the universe because every wish I made came true. And my first wish was, I'd like to have an audience with the Dalai Lama. He had taken so many people up to the monastery in Dharamsala that, believe it or not, he had the Dalai Lama's email address.
I did not know that the Dalai Lama kept in touch an email. That's awesome.
Well, I don't think he actually uses a computer too much himself, but all of his direct aides, they all have email. They all answer their email. And in fact, the Dalai Lama has built an email computer center that's attached to the monastery. So I had the unusual opportunity to write the Dalai Lama an email and ask him if I could come there for an hour and talk to him about 10 questions for our time.
And what were some of the things that you had asked him?
Well, that's really a large part of the story of the movie, because when I did get through to him, and amazingly, you know, I thought sending him an email might not work. What could be worse than getting into the Dalai Lama's spam filtering system or something like that? But amazingly, 3 days later, his aides contacted me, and I think they were trying to put me off of it. They said, it'll be at least 3 months until you could see him. Well, I was there for 5 months, so I said, what day? And they gave me a day, and they said, how long would you like? And I said, an hour. And they said, that's fine. You'll have 10 questions. And thus a film was born, because I began to wander through India seeking these, what would be the 10 questions that anyone would ask. I asked my friends, my colleagues, I emailed people, sometimes perfect strangers. And I got every kind of idea back. Some were good and some were silly. And filtering those and then thinking through my own life and my own perspectives, I came up with the 10. Wrote them down. He never saw them before we began the interview. And that's what I bring. That's part of the story of the film. There are a lot of questions that you would ask the Dalai Lama if you had that opportunity. I wanted to ask him about, well, culture, because I've done a lot of traveling around the world, and I've noticed how significantly our Western culture has impacted other cultures around the world, and how badly other people want to be like us. And sometimes I wonder if those people are not losing their native traditions, their ways of life, their spiritual beliefs, in the process of going so far as to embrace our Western way of life. And so one key question for him was, how much should we be preserving tradition, and how much should we be embracing the modern world? The answer is in the movie. It's a long answer.
And an incentive for folks to go see the movie. In the course of making the film and in the course of asking for feedback about what to ask for the Dalai Lama, I imagine that given the Dalai Lama's position as something of a, well, esteemed figure in certain circles and in a reviled figure in other circles, that it may have elicited a similar kind of back and forth as far as appropriate questions, inappropriate questions, positive and negative feedback. What was the realm of feedback like in the course of making this film?
You know, I was amazed at how open the office of the Dalai Lama is. They really did not in any way try to manipulate any of the questions or change any of them, and nor did His Holiness. I think he enjoys the real interaction between people. He brings a lot to the table, but he likes it when someone is challenging him and making him think and helping him grow as well. I did not, you know, shy away from issues like, how should we be engaging China? It's a major issue. How can you not hate a country, in essence, that deposed you, forced you into exile, and then executed thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of monks, and destroyed all the monasteries? You know, and I think it makes his compassion all the greater that he's suffered so much, and yet can still urge a peaceful resolution to world problems. So I was not censored, or you know, the back and forth was congenial. I mean, he believes in peace, and he believes in engagement with the Chinese to solve the problems that he personally is facing with his country.
That kind of leads to one question regarding religious tolerance that comes to mind. Certainly, prominent figures within various religious faiths will speak openly regarding a tolerance toward other faiths, and yet you may not necessarily see that among other practitioners with the faith. There's actually one particular example that's actually pertinent to Buddhism. I happen to have an article here that was published in the Grand Rapids Press in Grand Rapids, Michigan. A little bit of an aside, it turns out Grand Rapids, Michigan is my hometown. The headline, "Protests Greet Buddhist Visit to Catholic Church." A number of Buddhist monks were giving a performance at the Basilica of St. Adalbert's in Grand Rapids when it turns out that about 50 people from a nearby town in Allendale were coming to protest the event. It's kind of like struck me as at least bringing forth to the issue that of supposed religious fundamentalism and the questions about tolerance. What are your thoughts on the matter?
Well, in fact, that's one of the key fundamental questions of my life and of this film. I have traveled the world for 20 years, and one of the questions I've always asked myself is, how can I be tolerant of intolerance? Because I think it's a fundamental question for our time. I think fundamentalism is a dangerous area, because it, and I believe that in a political sense as well, that when you just believe one doctrine, and you're just going from that doctrine, you're in essence blind to much of the rest of the world and to openness of thought. And I asked the Dalai Lama, you know, if you have all the answers, don't you really have no answers at all? And if you're admitting that you don't know anything, isn't that kind of having the answer? And it was very profound what he said. He's a great believer in religious tolerance. And he believes that there are many, many ways of coming to a spiritual awareness and enlightenment. And I think, you know, whenever you see him go anywhere in the world, he's always part of interfaith ceremonies where people find common ground instead of emphasizing the differences in doctrine or behavior or history. And I think that's why he's such an important symbol to us. And a big part of that, of what you just asked is part of the focus of this film.
On the question about the Dalai Lama, he will be arriving in Chicago in early May 2007, and he's expected to draw what will probably be a very large audience to witness him. And this is actually kind of typical, no matter, it would seem to me, wherever he travels. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think explains that appeal?
I think that today there's a lot of cynicism about both political and religious leaders. We just tend to naturally distrust them, and we are looking desperately. We're in a time of war and conflict and red versus blue and right versus left and who knows what else versus what else. We're acting so much in opposition to each other and to the world that we're desperately seeking a message from a man like this, a man who can step forward in humble robes. And even though he's a worldly celebrated figure and can draw stadium audiences to him, travels by coach everywhere he goes, stays humbly, prays, and lives on $10 a day. And he can come to us with this simple objective, to speak the truth from his heart and to try to heal some of the suffering of mankind that's going on today. I think that that will always draw humanity to be in his presence.
In the course of you making this film, did you, your opinion about the Dalai Lama change, heighten? Was it affected at all? I imagine it would be by the making of this film, and if so, in what ways?
I have a profound respect for him, and I have ever since I first heard his voice and started to understand what he represents. To me, though, he's grown from a figure like Martin Luther King or John F. Kennedy or, going back in time, Gandhi. He's not an abstract figure that you'd read about in a book. It's a man I've met, I've sat down with, and I've gotten to know. And I've learned that he's a playful, ingeniously playful, happy, almost childlike sense of humor, spontaneity. And these things you don't necessarily get out of reading what he says. And so making this film has given me a three-dimensional experience of this man and a profound respect for him. And I just have to say to your audience that I'm a vessel to bring more awareness of him out there in the world. And I'm just blessed to have had this opportunity.
In the course of making the film, there are no doubt a number of challenges that were arrived at, that some of which you've described previously in this interview. What, in your opinion, do you think was the greatest challenge in the course of making this film?
Well, this may seem insignificant, but we had our wireless mic fail right as the interview began, right before. And I'm sure you're in the radio business, you know how devastating that can be, especially when you're in a live situation and you have limited time. And it was so funny because, you know, here we were nervous to begin with. I didn't want to blow it. We had been told by his aides that if he senses that things kind of are not going well, or it's just your agenda and you're just saying what you think over and over, he will end things early. And my fear was, oh my goodness, you know, he's going to send us off. We fixed the mic, and I walked back up to him and I said, "Sir, I don't know, Your Holiness, I don't know how to put this on to you. I don't want to touch you or..." And he grabbed it away and he said, "Give me that. I've done this a million times, you know." he wires it up in about 2 seconds and he's saying, "Testing, 1, 2, 3. Is it good? Is that good on your VU meter over there? It's good? Okay." And instead of making it into an awkward situation, he played with the situation, made everyone laugh, made us all relax, and boom, we went right into a more than an hour discussion. And it went so well that after that, he invited me to stay with him for the day at the monastery to film a huge festival and to have full access to his secretary and his relatives to interview them as background for the movie.
A last question, Rick. What would you count as a success for the distribution of this film, or as a goal for having achieved this film?
I just want people to not lose sight of what a great man is living on our planet with us right now, of his message. It's needed more than ever. Other things pull us away in the media environment today to look at them. There's a great deal of terror in the world. There are wars being fought. There's starvation. This man addresses these things, but he gives us answers that we can really believe in, answers without a strong agenda, just coming from a heart of love and compassion. And my excitement about getting this film distributed and into movie theaters is that now I can share that on a much larger level with the United States and with the world.
We've been speaking with Rick Ray, who is a filmmaker and also the director, cinematographer, writer, and producer of the film 10 Questions for the Dalai Lama, with an interview with the leading figure in the Buddhist faith. And Rick Ray has been talking to us over the phone from Santa Barbara, California. Rick Ray, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was an interview with filmmaker Rick Ray about his documentary about the Dalai Lama. To learn more about the film, go online to rickrayfilms.com. That's RickRayFilms.com. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. And now, Glenn Ford with a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
Barack Obama has delivered the third of his long national security speeches and has once again revealed that he is an imperialist at heart. Speaking at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, Obama envisioned a century in which the U.S. would lead the world in battling immediate evils and promoting the ultimate good. Battling evil, promoting the ultimate good, sounds very much like George Bush's rationale for doing whatever the United States pleases in the world, under the assumption that the Americans know what the ultimate good is. Of course, Obama also called for more respect for the United Nations and other international institutions, and for increased efforts to forge alliances whenever the U.S. finds it necessary to go to war. But that's all empty talk, a cover for his real intention to increase U.S. capacity to meddle in other people's affairs. The U.S., he says, must maintain the strongest, best-equipped military in the world in order to defeat and deter conventional threats. The United States already spends more on war-fighting capacity than all the other nations on the planet combined. The U.S. maintains 730 military installations in 50 countries around the globe. But that's not enough for Barack Obama, who calls for an enhanced ability to put boots on the ground. He told the Chicago foreign policy crowd he strongly supports the expansion of American ground forces by adding 65,000 new soldiers to the Army and 27,000 Marines. In other words, while Obama gives lip service to disentangling most, although by no means all, U.S. troops from Iraq, as president, he would send them elsewhere and add nearly 100,000 more to the mix. This is not a man of peace. This is an imperialist bent on further U.S. expansionism. Obama patters on about the need to avoid bullying other countries. But bullying is precisely what armies, navies, and air forces are all about. Obama talks sweetly, but wants to carry an even bigger stick than George Bush. All he promises is that he will be more judicious and thoughtful in using that bigger stick. History shows such promises are never sincerely made and are never, ever kept. There is only one peace candidate in the Democratic primary race, Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich. He's the only one that actually voted against giving Bush war powers in 2002, the only one to vote against providing another nearly $100 billion for the war this year, and the only one who categorically rejects going to war with Iran. Only Kucinich would withdraw all U.S. troops from Iraq and withdraw the more than 100,000 U.S. contractors, a euphemism for American mercenaries paid for with U.S. tax dollars. Obama and the other candidates say nothing about these soldiers of fortune, although they are an integral part of the U.S. war machine. Barack Obama is busy trying to prove that he is a statesman. There is no reason to doubt that he wants to run the American state and for the Americans to run the world. All Obama really promises is to be a bigger, better, smarter imperialist, one with a much bigger military, if anybody decides to disagree. That is the definition of an imperial statesman. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now conclude this episode with announcements of some upcoming events in the Chicago area. His Holiness the Dalai Lama will be teaching at the Harris Theater in Millennium Park at 205 East Randolph Street in Chicago, as he makes his first appearance in Chicago since 1999. The teaching will be in two sessions on Sunday, May 6th, which begin at 9:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. respectively. For information about ticket prices, visit the website DalaiLamaChicago.com, spelled DalaiLamaChicago.com. The film, 10 Questions for the Dalai Lama, begins its Chicago run at Landmark's Century Center Cinema in Chicago beginning May 4, 2007. For airtimes, visit LandmarkTheaters.com and click on the Chicago link. That's LandmarkTheaters.com, with theaters spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E-S. DePaul University in Chicago will host The Crisis of Civil Liberties in the Post-9/11 Era, an evening with Professor David Cole from Georgetown University Law Center. The presentation will be held on Wednesday, May 9, 2007, beginning at 6:30 p.m., and will take place at the Cortel U Commons on the Lincoln Park campus of DePaul University at 2324 North Fremont Street in Chicago. The cost is free and open to the public. To find out more, contact the Society for International Affairs at Chicago at siadepaul@gmail.com. That's siadepaul@gmail.com. And the National Lawyers Guild Chicago chapter invites you to a reception with two distinguished lawyers, Lynn Stewart and Erica Thompson, on Friday, May 11, 2007, from 5 p.m. until 7 p.m., with a discussion to begin at 6 p.m. The event will be hosted at the law firm Kinoy Terran and Gerati PC at 224 South Michigan Avenue, Suite 300 in Chicago. To learn more, contact the Chicago chapter of the National Lawyers Guild for more information. You can email contact@nlgchicago.org or call 312-913-0039. You've been listening to The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff at WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.